Here, we give it a try.
Thank you for joining us. My name is Kavita Hardy. I'm here with Jody Roberts and Charles Letta. Today is April 23rd, and we're here in D.C. for the TSCA Oral History Project. What we wanted to start with was sort of your educational background, if you can start that far back.
I'm going to go really far back, because I'm I have a somewhat unusual background. I grew up on a farm in Iowa. My father raised purebred livestock, and I went to a rural high school. I graduated in a class of 14, and went to Iowa State as a chemical engineer, graduated from Iowa State happily. Had an academic interest in chemical engineering. Had a National Science Foundation grant for undergraduates while I was there, and so on. But did not then go graduate school in chemical engineering. Instead, after a hiatus, I worked for Procter & Gamble in products research for a year in Cincinnati, which was a chemical engineering job. And went in the Army with an infantry division for a couple of years, and then went to Stanford Law School. I guess you'd include as part of my education clerking for a circuit judge on the Ninth Circuit, and then for the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, which brought me to Washington.
What brought you to law school? Having been a chemical engineer,
I was a capable chemical engineer, but actually, academically, that was not my best subject matter. Mm-hmm. The law fitted my subject matter intellectual interests even better than mm-hmm. chemical engineering. I was a Sputnik kid. I could do chemical engineering and do it reasonably quite well. I graduated from high school in 1958. That was the Sputnik year. And anybody who was reasonably intelligent then and could do it went off into that area, and I certainly could do it. So it wasn't a problem. It's hard to convey an understanding of that to someone like yourselves.
Why is that?
You just don't have the context, the historical context, to understand what was happening in this country in 1958.
So when you're in law school,
was 58.
In law school, was there an area in which you focused?
Well, not really. I mean, Stanford is not a big school. It doesn't really have subject matter areas that it emphasizes. It rather emphasizes broad areas. There were several areas that were quite attractive to me. One of them was jurisdictional issues, federal-state relations, that sort of thing. There's a course called Federal Courts that you probably haven't run into that is kind of intellectually demanding but great fun. And I did like administrative law, and I did like certain litigation topics.
So once you got to Washington, what brought you to the CEQ in particular? Or is that directly where you went?
No. I had worked as a law clerk to the Chief Justice. It happened that he was acquainted with Russell Train, who was the first head of the Council on Environmental Quality. And Russell had just been confirmed as the head, and he wanted some lawyers. And I was recommended. Was convinced to take the job. It turned out one of my classmates also had matching clerkships and also classmates at Stanford and also joined the council at the same time.
And who was that?
Bill Lake, William Lake.
What was the perceived need for lawyers at that time?
Oh, I don't think there was much doubt about the need. One of the first things we ended up doing, and actually, I was trying to think. But anyway, I remember drafting a set of executive orders allocating responsibilities under, I'd have to struggle to remember it. There was a set of acts that dealt with oil pollution control. And there was no other central place in government for environmental matters but this little tiny office in the executive office, and that's what I did that. Then I was one of the people who worked on the reorganization plan to actually create EPA mm-hmm. and NOAA. And that happened. And then, I went on to other things. A lot of it was treaty. I won't say primarily, but a lot of it was treaties and conventions mm-hmm. in the environmental area, especially shipping, and the early days of the Law of the Sea negotiations.
Did you have much interaction with what might now be perceived as environmental issues during either of your clerkships? Was there anything during those two clerkships that might have prepared you for time at the CEQ?
No. Well, yes, but if you talk about purely environmental issues, the answer is no. If you talk about federal-state relations, if you talk about various enforcement mechanisms and how they actually work and what happens, if you talk about judicial review, all those things, those were things I became necessarily more familiar with than most people who had just finished law school.
So are those the concepts that you were drawing on when you're when you're participating in this creation of
Definitely.
The environmental
Definitely.
Framework?
And in fact, I guess I ought to say that usually law students do some writing in law school, and I had been on the law review at early on in my second year, written a note on an administrative law topic dealing with maritime law. So I from fairly early time started on those areas.
So at what point did you start getting involved in toxic stuff, and why was that an issue?
That became,
or if you prefer, rather sort of how you, no, what other things you took?
I was working on other things primarily.
Okay.
As I mentioned, these shipping matters, control of pollution, ocean discharges, that sort of thing. Water pollution issues. I had responsibility is too strong a word for it. I had some work on the Corps of Engineers implementation of the National Environmental Policy Act at the very early stages. People knew I had been a chemist. Chemist is too strong. Actually, I probably took more than enough courses in chemistry to get a chemistry major, but I really was a chemical engineer. And people were aware of that. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
Did there seem to be a lack of expertise in those areas?
No. I'll tell you why. We had one of the three members of the Council on Environmental Quality, a man who had been a geophysicist at Caltech, and he was about as technical as you could possibly get. And I did work with him fairly frequently. But,
and who was that? Do you remember?
Gordon MacDonald.
So what were the expertises that were brought to CEQ? So you have this very technical scientific. What else?
Well, Russell Crane had been almost a classically trained, he's still alive, you can read all you want about him, but he had worked on the Hill, he had worked in the executive branch, he had been a judge of the tax court, for heaven's sake. He's an interesting man. And Mr. Kahn had been a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. He's an interesting guy. So those were the main people. Then we had a couple of, you've heard about, the chief staff people there. I don't have to tell you about Al Holm and people like that. You've already heard about them, probably.
I'm sure we could hear more.
Okay. Well, not from me, necessarily. His office was right across the hall. He was an interesting man. He was almost a consummate bureaucrat. I don't mean that unkindly, but it sounds like I do, but that's not what I mean. He knew all sorts of things about how to get things done in government.
Can you talk about the relationship between all of you folks, since it's a pretty small group?
It was a very professional group. How to describe this? People recognized and valued, I suppose, the talents of each of the people and tried to work constructively in light of those talents. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. The group actually turned out a fairly substantial annual volume of reports on what was going on with the environment, even while carrying forward with all these substantive initiatives. It's rather remarkable. Interesting group.
Yeah.
And Terry was among the more interesting people. You've talked with him, you know he has a personality that is very easy in the sense that he's a softly spoken person and fairly precise and so on. He and I got along very well. We actually wrote a chapter in a book that West Publishing issued called Federal Environmental Law. It dealt with institutional arrangements. He had written a separate chapter in that book, probably on this act, I don't know. I've forgotten. I was going to bring a copy with me this morning and forgot to bring it along. And I had written one on ocean pollution.
So can you talk about your work with him on the construction of what becomes the Toxic Substance Control Act?
Only in general terms. I actually pulled out the current act as amended, as adopted, as enacted in 76, and then as it's subsequently been amended.
It's
and
very different than that.
Well, it is and it isn't. It isn't, because it's just a lot of the things are rearranged, but you'd expect that. I think the short answer is yes. One can say we started basically from a model that drew upon the experience with the Food and Drug Act. He probably told you that. I don't know if he did or maybe he didn't, but that's the legal construct. From my perspective, that's where we were starting. I had, during my year as a chemical engineer at Procter & Gamble, I had worked on what for that company was the first new drug application I put forward from the soap division. You know of Safeguard soap?
Mm-hmm.
And the claim you don't. Okay. But in any way, it's an antibacterial or, you know, that sort of thing. And because it was making antibacterial or wanted to make antibacterial claims and deodorant quality claims, they realized or recognized they had to go forward with a new drug application. So I knew I had worked pragmatically from the standpoint as of an engineer, as a very junior engineer on that project. So I had a half a clue what the Food and Drug Act was all about. I wouldn't say more than half a clue, but I did have that. And with what people had in mind, that seemed the best model. And you'll find, as you go through even the current act, there are hints that that was the model.
So, two things in that. What did people have in mind? And what did you end up drawing from the Food and Drug Act?
Well, there were basically two things. At least two things, let's put it that way. First, the goal was to try to get a mechanism of pre-marketing and distribution and sale review of certain chemical substances. As soon as you say that, you think, aha, that looks a little like the Food and Drug Act and its regulation of drugs and devices. There also is a section buried in here that was viewed as quite important at the time. I know it's less important now in historical context, I guess, although I've never litigated these things. An imminent hazard provision, because the FDA also has the authority to go in and deal with food recalls. You've all heard of food recalls and things like that. And there is something akin to that built in here. Yeah. So that's why I say what I say. Now, I don't know if Terry said that. But
well, I think he doesn't, and I think part of our interest in wanting to talk to you was that his story is that he didn't have the legal background to understand how to make something like this law look like a law. He had ideas on how it might function bureaucratically,
right,
and from a governance perspective, but not the legal wit to understand how one actually turns those ideas into a law, and that was where he really relied on you, was to provide a legal basis for how and why you might be able to do some of these things.
Well, I just, with those two really basic fundamental points, indicating to you why that model was chosen. It isn't that it was a necessary or assumed thing, it's just given what he wanted to do, that was the best form that people would understand.
Would you say that using that model for this law made this law look different than some of the other environmental statutes?
Yes.
What was the model for some of the other environmental statutes being used?
Well, it was more of a direct regulation by way of either permits or approvals or that sort of thing. This one works a little differently.
Can you talk about how?
Well, I can. It basically requires a notice if you're planning to use a new substance. It requires, it contemplates review. You have to come forward.
Is this TSCA now, or TSCA as you and Terry wrote it?
Both.
Okay.
It doesn't. Yep. As I say, some of the elements are rearranged, and I was looking at this yesterday afternoon, and I had to smile. But, you know, it's, some of these are carried forward. When you come forward with your initial notice, you have to come forward with what information you have on the physical and other characteristics, including safety and health characteristics. And then there's a mechanism for further review and indeed testing. And there is a mechanism for allowing a sale or distribution or marketing while the testing is going on, and then there are others that don't. There are also limitations on It's too strong a word. There's the ability of the administrator to call for testing of something that has been marketed as well. There are a couple of things in the Act, like PCBs, that we just didn't deal with. There's a special section on PCBs. We said, well, fine. There were issues like that we didn't try to deal with, because that came later, and there was a special concern about PCB. There still is, in a sense.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that you were looking to get the information that the companies had submitted. Was there...
Not submitted. They might not have submitted it anywhere. They might just have completed internal studies.
Okay.
I was very familiar... Very. That's too strong a word. I was, having worked for Procter & Gamble, Procter & Gamble is a very competent company. It was then, anyway. I presume it still is. I don't know. But it was a very competent company, and the health and safety testing they did before they marketed something was quite extensive. And so I was aware of the kinds of internal tests that might be in hand, but not published necessarily.
So you expected that by asking companies for what they already had...
They would get a fair amount of information. A lot of it actually might be confidential, and there are provisions for confidentiality shot through this thing. But
that would be enough for EPA
to get started. So they wouldn't have to deal with generic chemical families of compounds and that sort of thing and try to extrapolate.
Are you the only one who had prior chemical industry experience who was working on the CEQ at this
point?
So that seems like it was pretty important that you knew more than some of these others that these companies already generate a lot of internal testing.
Oh, I don't know about that, because I think there were a number of people who had been fairly experienced generally with the world. I mean, I wasn't that old at that time, you have to recognize. But, you know, I had done what I had done.
Mm-hmm. So there's a couple interesting pieces. One is that you talk about the open flexibility that the system you're designing has, like the FDA, and that the addition of very specific mandates in the statute, like PCBs, et cetera, come in at the last minute.
Well, they come in...
Later. Not the last minute. Later.
They're driven by, in this case, political concerns as much as anything else.
One of the things that we've encountered time and again over the course of some of these interviews, however, is that it was those specific mandates that were very easy to enforce, and that it was the inherent flexibility of the system that tripped them up very often, because they weren't exactly sure what to do. I don't know, there's a couple of different ways that one might look at that, and I'm curious about your take. One is that TSCA doesn't look like the other environmental statutes, which made it a problematic statute inside of EPA.
It should not have been problematic.
So talk about that.
Well, when was the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act enacted? I don't have it. Had to be around the turn of the century, the prior century. And it had a similar set of goals, but with foodstuffs in mind. And one thing a good lawyer realizes fairly quickly is that ambiguity and studied ambiguity can be a very useful thing. Mm-hmm. Because it, you say flexibility, well, it allows adaptation to different circumstances, mm-hmm. put it that way. And one of the things I'd written was a symposium on Chief Justice Burger, and it had to do with, the title is Looking at Federal Administrative Law with a Constitutional Framework in Mind, and one of the things it does, if I can find it, is look at I'll find it. Interpreting older statutes in new circumstances.
Sounds relevant.
Well, no. If you think about it, though, mm-hmm. There are a set of statutes that have a fairly broad sweep, but and might have detailed provisions built into them, but they've been inserted there. That's not the main thrust. One of them is the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. Another are the patent statutes, mm-hmm. which go back to the first Congress. The copyright statutes. The Sherman Antitrust Act is one of those, for example. You can go down through and you can think about a set of statutes that affect our lives in terms of providing a kind of a general overlay. That was the idea. What people did with it, you know, you get to it, you're too young, but you get to a certain point and you realize, well, everybody has their own approach to things, and you're not going to be able to dictate to somebody 10, let alone 50 years, what they're going to do with something. So I'm sorry. I think I'll stop there. And won't make critical comments.
So it's interesting that you kind of create that framework for TSCA, because a lot of the other environmental laws, well, at least Clean Water, Clean Air.
And I worked on the Water Act, the legislative changes to the Water Act. I certainly knew the difference.
But they
even as a young
right, but they continue to be reauthorized, to be reworked, right, over the next few decades, and yet TSCA is never touched.
But you have to also recognize that maybe I'm defending the approach, but that's not what I'm trying to do, because actually I'll explain in a minute why. But if you look at what the European Union has done with their REACH regulations, it's very like this. Mm-hmm. Hmm. For good reason.
Very like what we have, or very like what you and Terry assembled?
What we assembled is not that different from what's actually in there.
Yeah.
I mean, I could go through and say, okay, this got moved from a separate section to the definitions, or, you know, they're very, it just looks a little different, but the pieces are there, with some additions like the PCBs and so on and so forth.
So it's interesting you say that, though, because I think people who are less familiar with the longer history and the longer story of this statute wouldn't see that connection, that it looks like this. And that many of the pieces that, especially in some of Terry's more recent writings, that he's arguing for in reform efforts, make it look more like what he thought it was supposed to be, implying that there's something missing, that some of those original pieces went missing. And I think they might be around things like a mechanism for pre-market review and how that gets played out. So it might not be that that element is missing from the statute,
it's
but that
not.
The mechanism right. for actually enforcing
it's one of
it.
The two.
Right, but I think the point is rather that things are, not that things are missing, but that over the course of the next 5 years, that they become more bureaucratic. And there's this process of making things much more complicated so that you lose that initial purpose and that
see, I think
what
that's,
you can do.
I'd say right now about 20 to 25% of the docket I get as a sitting judge on this court are tax cases. Mm-hmm. Right? Did I ever litigate? I was a litigator for 30 years, a little over 30 years. Did I ever litigate a tax case? No. Is it easy to cope with the tax code? No. And people have made it so complicated that you get down in the weeds so rapidly that it's just difficult. And I always have been a little bit of a conceptual thinker, so mm-hmm. you'll pardon me. I think a lot of these things are misguided.
And we're not critiquing
I'm just
you or asking you to defend yourself
you
in any way. Yeah, I mean,
you know,
because it takes a different form again from the Clean Water and Clean Air Acts, because those seem to be much more
prescriptive,
right? And they're not quite as conceptual, but we understand why conceptual
would not have worked,
right? But why it seems like a good idea
to whom?
Well, when you, I mean. I guess I shouldn't.
If you had had to work with it, it would. I'm sorry, it would have been easy for a bureaucrat, but
so
that's not a good idea.
Yeah.
So for someone who argues that TSCA doesn't work, would your response be that they're just not using it properly? That there are mechanisms inside of it that could address the things that they're concerned about?
Oh, that's definitely true. But if you just think about the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act and put that right here and TSCA right here, you know, fine. You can work with that. It's just don't think about it in the same way.
Yeah.
I mean, I was working at the same time with potential changes to the Clean Water Act, which subsequently were adopted right about the time I left CEQ, actually. And I had also worked on a fairly prescriptive regime in ocean dumping. There was a convention in implementing. So I knew the difference. Boy, did I know the difference. Mm-hmm. That would not have worked here.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any insight on that process of, again, you say it hasn't changed that much, but it did go through some negotiations both within the administration,
yes,
and then Congress. Do you have any insight on either of those processes? Probably more the former.
In February of 1972, I shifted from thinking conceptually and legislatively about some of these things to litigating cases. And that's what I did for the next 30 years. Yeah. I litigated a fair number of environmental cases along with a whole variety of other kinds of cases. But they were not, I never litigated a TSCA case, ever.
Huh.
So did I have anything to do with that statute? No.
Can you think of any difference that there would be in using TSCA on chemicals and using the Food and Drug Act on a new drug substance? So
there is a difference, and it's readily apparent. It ought to be so apparent you immediately say, oh, yes, there is. Can you tell me what it is?
Well, I can think of a few, but I'm curious what
you're saying. Let's try.
For your thoughts.
So my one...
There is one just astonishing difference. Go ahead, tell me.
With a drug, you assume that there's a pharmaceutical effect. When you're testing the chemicals, you're not really always sure what you're testing for. So there's a bit of a difference in approach of when the FDA goes to work on a drug compound. They both know what the efficacious effect of that drug is supposed to be. And it also has an idea of what it's trying to avoid. What are problematic flags? I think you would be concerned about potential adverse effects. And you have an idea of what those adverse effects might
maybe
be.
Maybe you do and maybe you don't. You really get surprised once.
But I think you might be
on the right track.
I think with Tusca, what I'm trying to draw out a little bit is there's the architecture of the law and then there's the implementation of it. And
you
can't separate them. But I think
really.
This is where it's interesting is that when they started having to implement Tusca, they had to start from virtually no record. And it seems like they very quickly got caught up in the mechanisms of the statute that had to do with collecting information about what's already out there. Within the way in which the Food and Drug Act
even
operates.
I was familiar with, I guess it's Section 8A, I'd have to look, because I never, as I say, this is not something I ever did, so I've heard about it.
Sure, but I think that there's, with the Food and Drug Act, you're dealing with one thing at a time coming through.
Well, let's be more explicit, though. What you're actually dealing with, you're right on the efficacy, because when the Food and Drug Commission approves something, it approves it for a specific use, which is why you get lots of people saying, I want to use drug X for my condition Y, and it's not approved for that, and you know, people get in real trouble if they prescribe for that. Mm-hmm. So there's a real difference. That does not appear here.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons is this deals, and I had to smile when I looked at the definition of chemical substance because it includes radicals. And you know, to a chemist, yes, that's kind of right because often what's active about something is its dissociation. Radical, which has the ability to do lots of things. But you couldn't prescribe what a given chemical substance would be used for.
Mm-hmm.
It just could be used for all sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
So you didn't have an endpoint in mind.
Mm-hmm.
That's the difference. But you were on the right track, from my standpoint.
I'll take some comfort in that.
No, I mean, I think there's a little difference there.
I think that there are these pieces about the ways in which one tracks chemicals is different than the ways in which one submits a drug to be approved. So there's also this approval mechanism, right? That the FDA approves that chemical for a use, and I think that gets back to your use
or
issue.
A number of uses.
The tension inside of EPA around Tusca sometimes seem to be, are we here to track all of the chemicals that are in commerce, or are we here to approve? But if the FDA, if the Food and Drug Act is the model then for Tusca,
no, it's up to, you know, it's a model, you know, it's just like the models that were used financially. Mm-hmm. They work up to a certain point and then they stop and you have to realize kind of what's happening. And it doesn't work after that point.
So where are the places in which that model starts to break down
start prescribing uses, which EPA can do. There's a possibility of that. But once they do that, then they have a potential for getting into real trouble because a chemical substance might have its highest and best use someplace else, mm-hmm. and they would never know. They wouldn't have the background to figure that out.
Mm-hmm.
They just wouldn't have a clue.
Were there ideas or provisions that Terry had that he had in earlier drafts or he had that he wanted to have included in the bill that you had to tell him weren't feasible inside of this model?
I don't think we had. We did have somewhere buried, I hadn't even thought about this yesterday when I was going through it, I just kind of treated it as a given. There is a use restriction possibility definitely in there. And that, there are also explicit references in here to the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, the Atomic Energy Act, there are a variety of them. And each of those also has that possibility. One of the big cases that I told you we have papers filed all over here, I'm working on what we call a SNF case, a spent nuclear fuel case, because Yucca Mountain is not available for the government to take spent fuel, and the NRC, regulates all this stuff. And anyway, you get the idea. I'm familiar with that exercise. Somewhere in here, there's the definite use restriction possibility. And I guess one of the things I was amused at is the fact that all these provisions are in coordination with other laws, which took a lot of time when we were going through the OMB clearance process. I forgot about, I don't know how I could have forgotten about, the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know why EPA would complain about this one, since that one is very like the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic.
Right. But in the ways in which you were just talking about, yeah, it exactly. approves and it provides labels for proper use. So it is... Yeah, it's much more specific, but you're also
you
dealing with
tell somebody. That's why there's a possibility of a use restriction here,
yeah.
But you have to kind of get there first. Mm-hmm. And I was looking at source material under the Atomic Energy Act, DOT on transportation of hazardous materials. That's more like the limitations. Occupational Safety and Health Act. There are certain kinds of things they require or can require. Anyway, you get the drift.
So you just briefly brought up the OMB clearance process. Can you talk a little bit about that?
If you want.
Yes.
What would you like to know?
How that dynamic works.
Yeah.
Like, so the taking of your draft that you constructed with Davies, the need for approval from...
Well, actually, it was more than that. It wasn't just the two of us plugging along, because... this was a fairly coherent and cohesive group over there.
Mm-hmm.
And you had all sorts of other people who could have a definite role. And then you'd bring in also certain agency people to try to figure out what some of the problems might be before you even went to the OMB process.
Mm-hmm. So now you're at the OMB process.
Well, who are you bringing in to help?
On
inform,
this one?
Yeah, what you were constructing.
You, I can't remember.
Okay.
I can remember who we brought in a couple of other instances, but I can't remember this one. Mm-hmm. We did.
So these are people from outside of CEQ?
Yeah, other agencies.
Okay.
Do you remember where they would have been from?
No.
Even if you don't remember that?
That's what I was trying to remember. I can remember working with the State Department on a variety of things. The oceanographer of the Navy. I mean, but they completely different context than this.
So, I mean, this would be, I guess, the potential issues that would be there. There would be state and international cooperation, the ways in which this extends.
Well, that's true, but that wasn't, preemption was a
yeah.
big issue, that was more of a hyper-technical.
What about commerce? I mean, since this, when it finally makes it to Congress, it's the Commerce Committee that really takes it up in the Senate.
Oh, we knew the Commerce Committee, all
yeah.
right. Even I did.
So was there discussion
I had worked with them on the staff on another bill.
Uh-huh.
Actually, so.
So was there discussion within the White House?
I would not have gotten involved with that sort of thing.
No.
I just didn't. Well, if I were asked, that's not exactly true. If I were asked a question, I would obviously respond. But was I trying to set the legislative wheels. No, that wasn't what I was trying to do. They didn't pay me to do that.
No, I wasn't. I guess I wasn't meaning it in that way. I just meant in terms of the review before this goes to, before it gets the official OMB stamp, what were the other executive cabinet level agencies that you were having to work with? I mean, so...
Well, you have to recognize...
So, I mean, this is going to affect the entire chemical industry.
Yeah, but you have to recognize this is the President's 1971 environmental program. We had just finished the reorganization plans and things like that. So you really didn't have an EPA in the sense that you thought about it for 20 years, 25, 30 years. So, you know, you were dealing with different folks because the environmental responsibilities were scattered around.
So there weren't other groups that were as interested in what was happening with the formation of TSCA?
Oh, yes. There definitely were, because this was supposed to cover a whole variety of different...
So what was their response to what was drafted?
Well, we had... I should start by saying that at the time, the person at OMB who was responsible for legislative reference was a fellow named Jim Hyde. Does his name come up?
Yes. Terry mentioned him.
He was wonderful. He really was. He was a gentleman of the first order. Very old-fashioned. Blind. Had been blinded through a wound at Anzio. Or it was, might not have been exactly at Anzio, but it was very shortly thereafter. And had a wonderful memory, had people read to him and he would remember, but he had a manner about him which was just terrific. He could listen to people and try to sift through what they were saying to get at what was really bothering them, because often, you know, we speak in elliptical terms, shall we say, or we're saying one thing when what we're really driving at is something else, whether we realize it or not. And he had a young staff who were very supportive of him in the best possible way. So it was, from that standpoint, a great process because he knew how to manage it.
So who were the other, were there other interested parties that he brought together to review what the CEQ had developed in terms of its TSCA bill before it became a part of the president's environmental agenda?
Absolutely.
Can you talk about who some of those people might have been?
Oh, gosh.
Or what interests they had or concerns they had or support?
Well, I can even remember dealing with the Atomic Energy Commission, believe it or not. Isn't that amazing? Anyway. I say the Atomic Energy Commission because they were an independent commission, and they had to be handled in a different way than one of the departments. Let's say the predecessor of HHS or Interior or one of those. So, you know, you had some problems here that had to be solved. You had to get their comments. In fact, I just yesterday, was it yesterday or the day before? I guess it was the day before, was a part of a group at the court who were asked by, the group was asked by the administrative office of the U.S. courts to comment on a draft bill implementing a convention that the State Department had set over. It had to do with enforcement of foreign judgments. And so on and so forth. And we had some comments on it. They finally realized the administrative office and the U.S. courts might know something about that, and they ought to be consulted. And, you know, it's consulting with the judiciary is a very different kettle of fish than consulting even with the AEC. But you wouldn't want to have something float up from the State Department that caused all sorts of heartburn from the judiciary, I don't think. so that somebody had the wit to use the right path, because we can't, as a court, comment, but the administrative office can. And we can say, look at X, Y, and Z.
So what were, you briefly said the word resolve, that things needed to be resolved between these different interests. Do you remember any of those discussions or what the concerns were?
Well, I can. Some of them appear in the draft bill and the statute, and some don't. Preemption was a big issue.
What do you mean by preemption?
What do I mean by preemption? Let's find. Oh boy. Now we're off the thrust of the statute, you realize. But this is this is still a hot topic today. State regulation, section 218 of the bill we put forward, and somewhere in the current statute, there's an even broader non-preemption provision. This is important. Not so much for, well, it can be important for the regulators, because they could do something, and a state could do something that could be at cross purposes with what they're trying to do. But it's much more important for the regulated parties. Preemption here is 2617. And I remember reading this yesterday, and it's actually much less preemptive of state regulation, which can be a problem. And there are, you know, interesting Supreme Court cases in the drug area on exactly this topic. Mm-hmm. That was one issue. Second issue that I remember we spent a lot of time on, because it had an echo, and more than an echo, in other statutes, was QI-TAM suits. Anybody ever talk to you about QI-TAM suits?
Mm-mm.
Citizen suits? Mm-mm. Talk with you about that? Terry talk with you about that?
No.
Yep. I suppose I got, this is a topic on which I got more grief than he did. It's just our perspectives were different. In the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, there are provisions for citizens to sue for violations of law.
Mm-hmm.
Not the government, citizens, right?
Mm-hmm.
It causes all sorts of problems, because you end up with an executive function being taken over by citizens. Well, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. Here, we didn't have any such thing in this act. Was not what we were trying to do. But it is in the, and we knew it, because we were at the same time, I was working on the Water Act particularly. If you look at the Water Act, there is a citizen suit provision in there. There is in this act, too, 2619 and 2620 is citizens' petitions. That actually is not really important. 2619 is citizen civil actions. When I say important, I don't mean that it's unimportant, because it can be important insofar as the administrative aspect of the thing.
So you're comparing for us what was submitted in 71
what ended up in
76.
This was an issue when we submitted it, because it had been something that was mooted or discussed in these other contexts, and we certainly knew what those other contexts were.
So is it relatively safe to say, without generalizing, that the places where there are difference in the piece submitted in 71 versus what's passed in 76 might also reflect some of the tensions that existed pre-publication of the draft in 71.
Yeah, sure.
And that those tensions just came back out during congressional
you'd expect
manhandling.
I think.
Yes.
But, I mean, that, let's say the citizen supervision, that's not a central part of what's going on here.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of another aspect. We had debates about judicial review. This follows a pattern much more like that in the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act than that which you would find in the Clean Water Act and Clean Air Act. I could tell you chapter and verse what the differences are, but do you really want to know that? I doubt it. Let's just think of penalties always kind of gets people excited. We had debates on. They're actually, the penalties are actually much, in the current act, are much closer to those that we put forward. They're very little change in substance. We had debates about search warrant authority, administrative searches.
Mm.
It's not a central part of this, but it can.
What about issues around
confidentiality? Was a really big issue.
Can you talk about that?
Sure.
That'd be good.
Anytime we talked about it previously in the context of requiring people to submit data that they might have that they were holding on a proprietary basis. And sometimes I think it was fairly evident that even the identity of the chemical substance might be confidential. In fact, could very frequently happen. And that's held forward or carried forward.
Mm-hmm.
We had to work our way through all those little things. And then the subsequent testing. To what extent were you going to make the subsequent testing results available?
What about questions who would be responsible for doing the testing?
Oh, I don't think there was much doubt about that. If somebody was going to come forward with a potential use of a new substance, they had to provide some testing. And you ended up with groups who were proposing to use it and the sharing of costs in the group. Mm-hmm. And then you always have the problem of free riders. Because they come along very shortly thereafter. And that's been a big topic. Again, I'm going to go back to the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act because you have generic drugs and all sorts of provisions regarding testing. And there you have patent protection. We can't have patent protection here, too.
And yet, under TSCA, one of the primary complaints is that the burden of testing and proof lies with the EPA and not on the company submitting.
That's not true. Who says that?
I think pretty much every group out there petitioning for reform of TSCA would argue
that.
See,
I don't know any of this because this is not what I deal with at all. I just don't.
You're very right that in the bill it says that manufacturers are held responsible, but that's not.
Well, they can. You have
provisions
for test rules and all this other stuff.
And I think that's what I was trying to get at in terms of thinking about the ways in which the law was written versus the ways in which it was actually put into use, that despite the fact that there are provisions that say things like the EPA can, those qualifiers, the ways in which they have actually been put to use over the last 30 years have created an institutional setting in which the EPA does not pursue those sorts of
That's pieces. Their problem.
Right.
I'm sorry. And actually, I should say that the only brush I've had with this statute over however many years it's been, 39 years, or I guess 34 years, because it took a while to get adopted, is this, I had mentioned before we started, that this son is running a startup business with a substance that was discovered by his university professors. Well, they have a patent on it, just recently issued, and they're plugging away. And it's subject to both TSCA and the REACH regulations in Europe. And so I'm very familiar with kind of what has happened in that area. And it happens to be an area that is somewhat sensitive. On the other hand, these are very, the chemical substance is very familiar to us all. Its form is not, shall we say, and it has very unusual properties. But it isn't something that you can just say it has this use and it doesn't have any other uses. That is just as far from the truth as possible, because they're marketing conductive inks made with this material now, and there are all sorts of other potential uses. And people are coming forward with tests, and they're doing tests, and so on and so forth. So I'm familiar with it. But how you would possibly deal with something like that in this context without this model, I don't know.
So how much was there a concern or debate over the need to not impede this type of technological innovation?
What type of technological innovation?
Well, it's just innovation in the chemical industry that...
Yeah, but I mean, why would anybody want to do that?
Do what? Impede?
Yeah.
Well, but inherently, some of the provisions do that. Right, I mean...
Well, that's the concern that comes up, right? That the formulation of any regulation over chemical substances, especially since this was broad-reaching, this was all chemical substances, would discourage innovation within the chemical industry. So, I think...
And the perception of the need to do testing, right, or to spend money on that.
So, I think I hear Kavita's question as trying to say how was the need to protect that space for innovation brought into discussions about how you would go about framing a regulation that is so broad and yet needs to allow space for the innovations within these companies to continue as unimpeded as possible.
That's part of the big, we had a discussion fairly early on about the policies certain companies apply in terms of making sure that the products they put out at all levels, actually, not just, but I had worked with a company that had consumer products. You probably have used a number of Procter & Gamble products in your time. Do you expect them to hurt you in any way? No.
I hope not.
Right. Right. You expect them to do what they're supposed to do and not have any untoward consequences. Well, they test fairly adeptly to try to figure that out. I suppose they get surprised once in a while, but I'm just not aware of too many surprises.
Well, I think outside of the surprises, I think it's more about this balancing of whether or not if one might be able to point back and gesture about whether or not TSCA has inhibited innovation in the chemical industry in the United States since its passing in 76. And that has gone quietly untalked about. I think it only arises when new changes might be on the horizon, and so this happened obviously with air and water over the years, and with new bills being introduced in both the House and the Senate to reform TSCA very recently. That's reemerged, that, you know, we were all in favor of reform, but we need to balance the ability to have oversight with the ability to innovate. I actually think there's a more interesting piece that I heard you saying before Kavitha answered her question, which is protecting the ability of the regulatory agency to adequately handle the products of that new innovation. That in constructing...
That's what we were driving at. That's right. Why there are potential use restrictions in there.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that by becoming overly prescribed in your statute, you miss what might be this new novel material that is looks like your old material but is actually radically different, and you'd
in
have
terms of
in its properties and its uses that you wouldn't have the ability to have oversight over that if you didn't have this built-in ambiguity or flexibility.
Yeah, that was the point. You got the point.
Right. I got the point, and I think we got the point when we first talked to Terry that was his idea, that what was revolutionary about this approach was that it was cross-media, it was systematic, it was complex, and yet when we talked to the people who were the directors of the Office of Toxic Substances or the assistant administrators, the difficulties of actually putting that statute to work were large.
I fear for us as a country if that's true, because this was pretty carefully designed so that you could deal with something that caused a problem without having all sorts of adverse, untoward consequences.
So how would you take what you've been telling us over the last hour and comment on almost an hour, about an hour, yes, and think about the call for reform? How would you?
I don't know what the call for reform is. I apologize for
my ignorance. No, it's fine. So imagine there is call for reform. I mean, would you basically
just
tell
them? Yeah, but that could mean anything. I mean, it could mean retrogression. It just means change. Yeah.
I mean, I think what we're trying to highlight in the project is really these sorts of the discussion we've gotten from you, which is you need to better understand what was actually in the original version. And
what the basic purposes of the exercise were, not all of, you know, we had a discussion about the forest and the trees, or getting down in the weeds before. You know, we ought not to be, the people who run this ought not to be doing that at a certain level. They ought to be at a certain level, conceptual thinkers, the people who actually set the use restrictions and or the test rules and so on and so forth have to be concerned with the trees and the weeds. But I mean, they're fine. They ought not to. Right.
Is there anything else you'd like to add about this process and what you remember?
It was actually instructive for me because I remember litigating a couple of, to me, quite interesting cases that actually I had a different approach to after because of this exercise. And one of them had to do with administrative search warrants and confidentiality. Somewhere, I don't have to find it. Oh, here it is. There's a case in the Supreme Court that I remember arguing called United States of America versus Stauffer Chemical Company, and it had to do with administrative search warrants. And anyway, it's 464 U.S. 165. It was decided in 1984, so it wasn't that much after this, but I was litigating. The company, or the EPA, had, under the Clean Air Act, had hired contractors to conduct a search or searches of certain kinds of chemical plants. And the people who ran the plants were quite concerned that the contractors would gather all sorts of information and not be subject to the same confidentiality restraints that EPA would in their subsequent work. And that just got to be, so it really was started off with a motion to quash an administrative search warrant in Cheyenne, Wyoming, Federal District Court in Cheyenne, Wyoming. But, you know, you never know how your past life can come around.
Yeah.
So I do a little bit about that issue when I start. In a kind of an odd, for an odd reason.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
No.
Yeah.
This isn't.